Okay. Welcome to CSC 471-598, Introduction to Artificial Intelligence. There's a handout that's actually not a handout, a sort of a quick feedback sheet that I sent around. You could fill this up and make sure that you give it to me by the end of the class. There are some simple questions about your background. So let me start with some general information. This is a good place to start because there are too many people here. Some of them are obviously in the wrong class, so they'll figure it out once we talk about what it is all about. So I am Subba Rao Kambhampati. You can call me Rao. Wow, that's great. We have a TA for this floor, which is Lei Tang. Yeah, you can just connect it. Lei Tang, who, as we speak, is busily attending a conference somewhere in Philadelphia. He will be back, I think, tomorrow, and then he will give his office hours by then. My own office hours are 3 to 4 p.m. right after the class. Let me check this thing if this works. Yeah, thank you. Okay.
There you go.
Yep.
I'll just come down and collect it in class.
Thank you. As you'll see, this class is a bit high maintenance, both on them and on you. So the TA is late and his office hour should be available very soon. The additional help, so I have a bunch of people who are very interested in helping people who are crazy enough to take this course. So they include Jay Benton, Garrett Wolf, Will Cushing, who was actually sitting here a while back, and Sang-Wu Kyun. All of these people could actually teach this course. They know enough about AI, but they just decided that they'll help me in getting the message across. So if you cannot get enough information from the classes and the TA hours, you're welcome to send an email to this pool of tutors, and one of who would then give you an appointment. You can go and talk to them one-on-one. Okay. So the basic idea is you have very few excuses other than your own life and time for not doing well in this course. Okay. So there are enough people who are going to help you if you need help. Okay. There is a course homepage that's Rakapush. It's not on black. What's that thing called? Blackboard. I hate Blackboard. So I'm going to maintain my own page. How many of you have not yet seen the course homepage? Okay, that's good. Very few people have not yet seen. So in general, I tend to keep extending the stuff on the homepage. There's already a bunch of things there, including some mails that I have sent for the people who registered as of last week. I think there are more people who registered after that, but I'm going to extend the mailing list. This lecture notes is where I'll wind up posting the slides as well as the audio. I'm recording myself. I really like my voice. And you can download it and listen to it if you don't listen to me here. By the way, I'll say it in a minute. These are all extra pieces of information. I still expect that you show up for the class. Okay, today is hard. But starting next week, I'll figure out who is in the class, and I expect all of them to show up every class. It's mandatory. There's some more stuff on the homepage. There's like tons of stuff on the homepage. You should just play with it and find out what else is going on. Let's see. There is a course overview, and this is something that's useful. Here, there is a whole bunch of information on lists, which you'll hear about a little bit. And there is a bunch of links to lecture notes for this course from the last offering, which was the last time I taught this was fall 2003. And the course notes from that are available. So if you want to go ahead and read everything up before I even talk about them, you can look at them. And also there's a schedule from last time that will give you an idea of the schedule that I might follow this time. However, I plan to change things around. Grading. Okay. This course is likely to, I mean, most of your grade depends upon the work that you do at home, not in class during test. Okay, as you can see, projects, homeworks, and participation would count for 55% of your grade, and there are approximately 4 projects. If you are good and do your project faster, I can make it 6. Okay, so it's all up to you. The expected background for this is that at least for the initial project, Lisp would be required. Lisp would be the language you would use. Why Lisp? Because you know, it seems as if, I think, in fact, there was a time, I've been here too long. I've been teaching AI, I think the first time I taught was in 1992. How many of you were born by then? Okay. Wow, good. So I have some contemporaries at least. At that time, you know, Lisp is what everybody doing AI would be using. Okay? I don't think that's the case anymore. In fact, my own graduate students don't use Lisp. I mean, I've been trying to whip them into shape, but they don't seem to use it anyway. So that's not the reason why we'll necessarily learn Lisp. It's sort of become like a ritual with AI. And it's a beautiful language. And you know, how many of you probably spent too much of your life doing programming in C++ that you don't know that there are better languages out there. And so just using it once is useful. And most of you are at least junior standing, and then the rest of you are seniors and graduate students. You should be able to pick up a language. Okay? So that's the because part of this. The homeworks, there will be homeworks, at least about 4 of them, and I would be throwing homework questions piecemeal. So I have this system called Pocket System. So as soon as I discuss something, I put a homework problem on that on the homepage. And those of you who want to do it when things are fresh in your mind, you can go ahead and start doing it. Okay? And normally, I close the Pocket and give you 1 week time to submit the homework. Okay. So if you wait until all the questions are set and I close the topic, close the homework, then you only have 1 week to do it. Okay. So this way, you know, you get to work on them earlier. Participation, I already said attendance is important. Attentiveness is also important. It's 1:40, all of you had lunches, good lunches, and you know, you'd like to sleep. I try my best not to let you sleep, but if you do sleep, I'll find out your name and send you mails. I already sent too many mails. I'll send extra mails about your sleeping habits. Okay. Do ask questions. Please, please, please stop me anytime you want and ask questions. If you're becoming a pest, I'll tell you separately, not in front of everybody, that you become a pest. You know, you should, yeah. Yes, sir.
Okay. When you say
list,
I know there's a lot of kinds of lists, and some people say students list. Is it going to be any old list?
Okay, that's a great question. First of all, point one points for you, just to know all that question. There are a million lists, but we will basically use common lists. Okay? Scheme is what I think 240 has started teaching of late. That's precisely why Scheme is extremely close to Lisp. And for the purposes of this class, Scheme versus Lisp. So I put up a link there where somebody was explaining for people who already know Scheme, how to do Lisp. Okay, and so you can look it up as a quick understanding of the changes. So basically, Scheme is a pure form of Lisp without any side effects. If those of you who know anything about Lisp from 240, you know that it's a functional language, and except it's not really just a functional language, it has side effects. Scheme, however, doesn't have side effects. Okay. So as languages go, Scheme is probably the supremely beautiful language, and Lisp is right next to it. Which reminds me of the following. I was, last couple of weeks back, I was at Google for a faculty summit, and somebody was talking about the following study they did. Okay, so as you know, some of you should know, there are not too many people joining computer science. I mean, despite you guys being here, we have lots of seats and not enough people are showing up to take them in lower level classes in computer science. This is not just ASU, it's not that we have problems. Across the world, across the US actually, the number of people going for computer science has reduced, and they were figuring out what was the reason, and one of the reasons is how computer science is taught, for example, at the AP, or basically advanced placement courses in high school, where they'll say C++. If you know how to do C++ programming, that's computer science. I don't know about you, but I once saw a T-shirt which basically said 25 years of research into programming languages and C++ is the result, question mark, okay? So C++ is actually a pretty bad way to learn computer science, not just because it's a bad language, but because computer science is much more than programming. I think all of you know this, right? And you don't tell people how to do programming right away, and even if you do, you would want to use the most natural programming language. Now, why am I going to all this? They actually changed the AP curriculum in, I think, Brown, and they made a bunch of high school students take this AP course, some of them, and of course, they wound up using Scheme rather than C++. And they also had a placebo group which wound up doing C++, and then at the end of the semester, they took, I guess, end of the many semesters, they took some sort of a survey as to which is better in terms of understanding the concepts. And across the board, boys, guys, men said, hey, you know, C++ is good enough. In fact, we could do assembly language. Girls, women said they loved Scheme. Now, I don't know what this tells you, but it tells me that aesthetic sense is better on the other side. You know, boys don't seem to know what's a good language. So those of you, women, girls here, you'll enjoy it a lot more because Scheme actually is a much nicer language to understand concepts. Anyway, that's a huge digression. We'll continue back to where we are. Any other questions? There was some question that got me to this. Okay. There is a midterm and a final exam. Either one or both of them might be take home, and I reserve the right to decide which one is a take home and which one isn't. That's basically the grading. Any questions on the grading stuff? Grade anxiety. What kinds of grades will be given? I love more grades. In fact, I always hope that there's one grade for each student in the class so that I could just, you know, sort the marks and then give grades one after other. So I like the fact that there's A+, A, A-, B+, B, B-, C+, blah, blah. I'll use all of them. I'll give all the grades. That's the way I would do my business. There are no preset grade thresholds. If you're not getting 90, you don't necessarily have to drop the course. I have given A grades to people who got 60s. That's because the top mark in the class that year might have been 90 and the second was 60. Okay? I would set exams that way. Again, telling you beforehand, you have one full week to decide whether you want to do this or not. I would give as many good grades as any other course would give you, but I'm not going to set my exam such that 90 would wind up automatically becoming A. I don't know how smart you are, okay? And I'm not going to decide the maximum smartness you're allowed to have in the class, okay? So I would pitch it high, and I'm always surprised that there are people who are way smarter than I expect. Okay? Despite my teaching, they seem to do quite well. So I will set exams hard, I'll set projects challenging, I'll set homework interesting, okay? And I will not have a preset threshold for grades, and the grades will be the marks would be converted into grades the night before they are due. And normally I get divine revelation on that night, and I just convert them. But in general, I've been in business for a long time, nobody sued me yet, so which means I'm not making too many people unhappy. Okay. The other important thing for you guys is this class is almost evenly split between 471 and 598. So there are half the people here are graduate students. Half the people here are undergraduate students. Okay. I do realize that graduate students have way too much time on their hands. they only take 3 courses and all that fun stuff. And they say they're doing research. I don't know. But so I realize that there is this issue there. The way I'm going to teach this course is I'm going to expect the same, I have the same exam, same test, same everything for everybody in the class. Okay, the same exact. Okay. At the end of the semester, there would be two different rows, one called CSE 471 row, one called CSE 598 column. And they would be separately given letter grades. So when I'm looking at the 598s, I'm only looking at the other 598s. And I'm looking at the 471s, I'm looking at only other 471s. And the only thing I'll guarantee is that if there is an effective threshold for a grade for 598, it would not be lower than that of 471, because then we'll have to cancel the graduate program here. Okay? So, you know, other than that, nothing, no difference. Everybody has the same exam, same test, everything. Okay? And in fact, I think it's actually very hard to differentiate the intellectual development between seniors and first-year graduate students. You know, you both have pretty much what you need to do well in your business courses. Okay, that's regarding the grades. Any questions on that? Okay. Honor code. As I said, everything, a lot of things in this class are going to be for home work. That means you get to do it at home. Okay. I do not believe in policing people. I didn't sign up for this, you know, this job to police. However, if you force me to police, I'll get you for it. Okay, so the another way of saying it is, I'll assume that all of you are honest, all of you know that you're supposed to do your work yourself, you're not supposed to copy, and more importantly, it's not just copying from other people, web is there. Okay, everything that I can ask you is probably answered in some class somewhere. Okay? And I think you are smart enough to find that. I mean, if you are not, my God, I mean, you have bigger problems than my course. But the assumption is that I'm not here to try and tell you that I'm going to set questions that nobody else in the world has ever set for any of their exams. The point is not whether other people know AI. Lots of other people know AI. The point is whether you know AI. Okay, so you are going to do your work yourself, even if the solutions are available. And I know some of you are smart enough to have probably downloaded solutions for this course that may have been available, you know, before I woke up and removed the link. Okay, the burden is on you. You have to make sure that you're not copying. And I know what my solutions are, and if I can prove that there is huge isomorphism, then you wouldn't want to be in that situation. Okay. This is all only time I will talk about this. I have never had major problems with people copying. I trust your judgment. If you have questions, you know, as to whether I'm allowed to ask somebody about this, etc., please ask me. Okay, like I said, there's a TA, there's a bunch of honorary TAs and all that stuff. There are enough people who can answer your questions. Okay. Life with a homepage, I'm not going to give any handouts. I think the great advantage of internet is I don't have to waste trees. You guys get to waste them. So I'll put them on the web, and all of you will print them separately at your home. So I won't bring any handouts to the class. I'll put everything on the web. I'll send emails on the list explaining to you anything that's been added and so on. And you are responsible for keeping track of the emails. Make sure that Subha Rao Come Home Party is not put in the spam box by Google. Okay, so you just make sure that. If, in fact, for 3 days in a row you didn't get any mail from me, that's not because I'm asleep. That's because probably you're putting my mails in spam. Okay, so normally I send a whole bunch of mails about the class. You don't have to read it, but essentially important announcements will all be made in emails as well as on the homepage. One important thing, I tend to use PowerPoint slides. I keep changing them until the last minute, and I keep hiding a whole bunch of them which I don't feel like talking about. Okay. So when you print, make sure that you don't print the hidden slide. Okay, because then you would have a harder time figuring out how come this guy didn't talk about any of this stuff, and there are like 70 extra slides on some topics that I haven't talked about. Okay, that's a useful thing to have. Like as I said, the slides, there are previous time slides that are available from F03. I tend to put slides for an entire week up front. Like, for example, this week's slides are already up there. I am an ambitious kind of a kid. I tend to think that I will complete 70 slides in one class and find that I do normally 10 And so it's not that exactly these number of flights will be completed in the first week. I might add, I might remove. The only time you know that the flights have reached a steady state is after that week is over. Okay, that's the usual thing. Okay, that's all about administrative stuff. I gave you a handout, and that asks you questions such as, are there any specific reasons why you are taking this course, and things like that. If you have any such reasons, please feel free to add them. Okay. Any other questions on administrative stuff that I need to answer? Yes, sir. Yeah. There's a book. The book is Introduction to Artificial Intelligence by Russell and Norvig. I again assume that all of you have figured this out, but so it's right here. Let's see, this one. This the second edition. It has a, one of the nice things about this book is it has a huge website, which is reasonably comprehensive, not just about the topics that they're talking about in the book, but also all sorts of extra information. Okay, so I would definitely keep myself familiarized with this homepage. The book itself is about that thing. Okay.
You go buy it?
What?
You go buy the book?
You should buy the book.
No, you teach by
it. Do I teach by the book? yes or no? Okay. Computer science, pretty much all topics are changing. Okay. AI is in the vanguard. So I would try to stick closely to the textbook. This is the best textbook, I think, that's out there. I'm in fact using several of their slides, as you'll see in a minute. But I reserve the right to add stuff. Okay? So that's why you read, you come, you listen to me, you go back, you read the book, you read the lecture, all that fun stuff. Other questions? Okay. If there are no other questions, then we will actually get to the job of starting this course. So I have to use this speaker that I got. Let me do that, and then we'll start. And where are we? So those of you who are afraid of darkness, it's okay. Lights are going to come back soon. Where are the lights? Does anybody know where the lights might be? That's light. More light. Can somebody there get those lights? If they have. All the lights are there? Okay. Give me a second. Oh, okay. That doesn't help. If you have any questions while I'm doing this, feel free to ask me. Like we're going to have the pleasure of this guy today. You have the extra things, right? Could you please try them? I'm sorry, if I don't do this, I'm worried that the course would be jinxed. I have done this every time I taught this course, so if I don't do this, what if everybody gets an F grade? That wouldn't be good. Okay, is this on? Okay, that's good now. Okay. Now what? Okay. Okay. Thank you. So now we are in firmer ground. I have done this. That's just the way this course has been started way too many times, and we have to do that. Otherwise, I would not be able to sleep well tonight. So basically, today what we're going to discuss is what is artificial intelligence and what this course is going to be about. Okay. If it is databases, I think most of you either know what databases are, or you would not have very overblown expectations as to what databases the course is likely to be. But because the name is artificial intelligence, and because we tend to have a lot of, is there any noise coming here? Okay, we tend to have a lot of pride that we are intelligent and nothing else is. It would be interesting to see what would actually be done in this course and what won't be done in the course. And in going there, we'll go step by step in starting with, let's say, the course overview, which is this, but I won't go into it right now because they won't make too much sense to you. Instead, what I will do is I'll talk about the definitions of artificial intelligence, try to make sense of those definitions, okay? In fact, this is all, again, from the textbook. And look at there are really four types of definitions. Is there some annoying noise in the background? It's a speaker. Which one? This one? That's not the one. Or this one? Okay. Yeah, I did mute them, but that's not the reason. It's probably the other one. Well, we'll have to give it. So there are different people have given different definitions for artificial intelligence. As I said in that course, first of all, how many of you actually took my mail seriously and figured out what was the point of that background graphic in the homepage? Okay. So at least there are some areas in computer science that are 50 years old. Okay, that's good. In fact, very few areas in computer science are 50 years old, as you can tell, right? Tell me some areas that are not 50 years old. Web and databases, like day before yesterday. Okay. So AI, actually one of the interesting things about that slide, you know, I hope you'll go back and look at them later on, is as soon as the very first computers were made, people weren't asking the deep questions such as what would be the largest Excel spreadsheet a computer can open. Okay, Turing didn't ask somehow. And we think that Turing is the father of computer science. He didn't ask that question. He asked the question, can machines think? Okay, so pretty much as soon as computers came on, people were wondering whether we can make them intelligent. And now we have come to a point where I can say, well, goal of AI is to generate intelligent software, but unfortunately, that's what everybody says. That's what everybody says. The market for decidedly non-intelligent software is extremely low. Okay, even COBOL programs would market themselves as intelligent business processing software. Okay, because nobody wants to buy non-intelligent anything. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about intelligent as the intelligent software because that's too generic. Okay, but unfortunately we are starting at a fairly high level. So the question is, if people are asked to define AI and what it's supposed to be doing, and if you put together all those definitions. One of the things that Russell points out is they fall in four different categories. Okay, maybe there are more, but I think these four are good categories to keep track of. One is the goal of AI is thinking. Let's start this. Goal of AI is to act humanly. So make computers act human. Okay, the other is make computers think humanly. I mean, we are self-centric ways of species, right? I mean, we think, you know, everything should be like us. And so even if we actually have aliens, they always have these two eyes and, you know, 15 arms. I don't even know why they should have arms, but that's the only thing we can think of. So thinking humanly and then thinking rationally and acting rationally. These are four ways of looking at the big goals of AI. Okay? By the way, again, to remind you, today's class is going to be stratospheric. Okay? If this is the only thing you are interested in, you would be unhappy with the rest of the course, because this is the maximum height we'll ever reach in terms of looking at the big question. Okay? Very quickly, what we'll be finding is actually writing programs that will be able to either act humanly, think humanly, etc. Okay? But for those of you who are interested in big questions, today would be fine. Okay, so let's look at each of these four one by one. Acting humanly. In fact, Turing, when he asked the question, can machines think, he's a brilliant guy. And he actually asked himself, okay, not only do I want to know whether machines can think, but I want to know whether we have, somebody says we made a machine that can, sorry, not machine, a machine who is as intelligent as humans, how do we tell? And so in 1950, he was writing this paper, which, by the way, you guys should read. It's fun. And it's easier to read than the original Turing papers on halting the Turing machines and so on, if you don't have background in theory of computer science. So the question he asked is, he set up a test called the Turing test, which, by the way, was the joke in the beginning of the class, you know, the Dilbert joke about Turing test. A Turing test essentially tried to see, what he said was, if a computer, if somebody who is sitting on a side of a wall cannot tell the difference between a computer and a human, then this computer is actually, as far as this guy is concerned, is a human. Now, of course, if you're not completely asleep, you would have realized that this could also mean that this human, as far as this guy is concerned, is a computer. Right? So, in fact, this is the most interesting definition of AI, and it has led to all sorts of cartoons as well as tests, competitions. There's a guy called Loebner, does anybody know Loebner test? Okay, Will Cushing doesn't count, he took this course. Loebner essentially has money. Turing is a scientist. Scientists don't have money. And so Turing comes up with the big ideas and he dies. Loebner in late 80s, early 90s decided that he will have a test called Loebner test, which is essentially a Turing test. But he will put up the money. And a bunch of people would write these programs which would try to fool a bunch of lay public into thinking that they are human. And every year, the program that would win the competition is the one that has fooled the most number of people from Boston, because that's where it used to be held. And so it also tells you something about the Boston public, but you know, that was the way the test was done. That's basically your Turing test. Okay? Now, there are all sorts of fun anecdotes about Loebner test. And one year, for example, a guy who essentially was a Shakespearean expert. Remember that to run Loebner test, if you only put computers on this side, even my kid can guess that, yeah, it must be a computer. Because I already told you that behind the wall only computers exist. So you have to have some humans and some computers. And you don't know when you are talking to them through your computer, you don't know whether you're talking to a human or a computer. Okay? And so you still have to be able to guess. And so they would get a bunch of people who would act, who would be doing this human side. And then they'll also have somebody write programs, you know, people who write programs can put their programs here. And then you have to decide, you know, as the programs that have been consistently shown to be, have been guessed to be humans, they win the competition. The one year, at least, I remember, a guy who was a Shakespearean expert was consistently voted to be a machine, because people thought nobody who has any life would know so much about Shakespeare. Okay, this is important because, as I said, Turing test, it's not clear what it is telling us. You know, Turing is a smart guy, and he actually, credit should go that he actually came up with this test. But there's a question as to whether, even if you do win the Turing test, would you have actually achieved anything in terms of AI. Okay? There is this problem that Turing test is not reproducible, it's not constructive, and you cannot really analyze it. You know, the guy who won 1 year, what do you learn from that particular thing? However, remember that we got to Turing test because we wanted to think of AI as, the goal of AI as acting humanly. Now one might say that forget about Turing test, do I even care about acting humanly? If I write programs, do I want the programs to act humanly? You know, in fact, I have this nice little thing saying mechanical flight became possible only when people decided to stop emulating birds. You know, and we still don't know how to fly like the way birds do in terms of flapping wings. So maybe we shouldn't really act like humans, you know. Yes, you had a question.
What does it mean when you say it's not constructive?
What does it mean? So if you win the Turing test, can you say which part of your big program has led to this win, that sort of a thing. So the idea is, I'm not just interested, I mean, the way Loebner test actually got done, bunches of people from the road will just come write programs and submit, you know, these guys really didn't care too much about the theory behind them, they wanted to win. Competition for exactly for that, okay? But after the competition, I should be able to learn and, you know, take forward the area. That is harder from the Turing test point of view. Now, I do want to mention that, you know, normally, 3 years back when I taught this course, I would have said, yeah, you know, AI should not bother about acting humanly. Because this was supposed to be my Strawman slide. You know, there are three Strawman slides and then one slide which says this is what AI is supposed to be. Except I'm going to argue today that all views of AI are actually equally important. Okay, I decided that that's what I'll do today. And I'll give you reasons. Okay? So because again, I assume that you have a life and you have been keeping track of how the world is going even before you came to this class, and you do know that one, that programs which actually act like humans have a lot of advantages. You know, there's a huge research area right now which apparently tries to do robots which will talk to older people who have nobody to talk to. Now, it's all because of you guys. You're not going and talking to your grandparents. Okay. But, you know, if you don't, then somebody else should. And then a robot, when it's talking, it better look like it's like a real human being. Otherwise, humans don't feel like talking to them. You know, you say, blah, 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 and all that stuff. And if you, for every little thing, you show like a complete, you know, face of bewilderment, it doesn't help. Okay, so in fact, acting humanly is important. If, in fact, this program is going to interact with humans, okay, I mean, after a long time, we won't even be needed, and then AI will take over. Hopefully, that's at least 2-3 years away. In between then, you want whatever you do to interact with other humans. Even if it's not a complete autonomous agent, it can be an assistant, an intelligent assistant. And an intelligent assistant which yells at you at the top of its voice saying, oh, what a stupid guy you are supposed to have made a right turn there, that assistant would be thrown and removed, taken and removed from the car. It has to act empathetic. It has to act, you know, it has happened to Turing, you know, the smart people have done this, you're also like that, and you know, something like that. So the point I'm trying to make is, acting humanly, you may want to figure out how to make your programs act humanly. Here is another example. One thing we'll figure out is, in trying to write intelligent agents, autonomous agents, one of the biggest bottlenecks, it turns out, and I'm kind of jumping ahead, is we can write programs that can give highly paid medical experts run for their money. We can write programs that can give highly paid geologists run for their money. We can write programs that will make highly paid NASA scientists run for their money. We can't yet write programs that will make a 4-year-old child run for his or her money. Common sense that we all take for granted is hard right now still for putting it into the program, because that's kind of there everywhere and you're supposed to know, and then writing it all into the program is a pain. So one idea would be, how do kids figure this out? Do kids come into this world with huge amounts of common sense? I mean, how many of you still think, for example, I hope none of you are, that people who are born in, kids who are born in America have English genes, and people who are born in Hyderabad have Telugu genes. That's not true, right? Basically, we come with the same exact mechanism. And based on the environment, we learn. We tune the knobs, we figure out what phonemes are worth it, what phonemes are not worth it, and we learn huge amounts of knowledge. Okay, if you touch the hot stuff, you know, it will singe you and all that stuff. Now, who is teaching all this stuff to us? People, parents. Why aren't they teaching you? You have to pay me to teach you guys. You know why? Because you're not cute enough. You're not cute enough. Kids get taught because kids are cute. Okay? I mean, especially my kid is extremely cute. And, you know, yours maybe or may not be, but kids are cute. Now, the important thing here is the following. If I'm trying to make a robot which will learn by being taught, the teachers would be people like you. Are you going to sit in front of a robot and teach it? Oh, by the way, if you have water, it'll always flow downhill. Or, by the way, if Magellan went around the world 3 times and in one of his trips he died, he would have died on the last trip. How many of you have trouble with that? That's common sense. Nowhere have you read that if somebody goes around the world 3 times and if they die in one of the trips, it must be the 3rd trip. Nobody ever told you that specific thing, but you just know it. Okay? Now, you need to teach these two robots. Now, if they're not cute, you're not going to teach it. So what did, there's this project called COG project in MIT, where essentially, this is an ugly looking robot which has some cute mouth and cute eyebrows and cute, you know, things like that. And so people would just, I mean, we are evolutionarily made to fall for certain types of cuteness. You know, whether Pat Robertson likes this or not, that's the way we have been evolving. Okay? And so what COG, the creators of COG did was they basically co-opted our interest in keeping and talking to cute kids such that we would talk to this robot, which actually is quite ugly. But it has some of the things that we think are cute. That's coming from acting humanly. Okay, so some of these things, we do want to figure out how humans act so that we can mimic them, even if in fact we want to generate autonomous agents. Another interesting thing, actually this is something that wasn't a big deal 3 years back when I taught this course, but it's a huge deal right now, which is not as much about acting humanly, but about Turing test, which tries to tell humans and computers apart. How often do you need to figure out whether the thing that you are interacting with is a human or a computer? None of you are having high quality lives. So you mostly are just hanging about either just computers or just humans, and you know, you don't have to figure out who is who. Okay? However, this is a huge problem right now. How many of you have seen this? This is, if you open an account on Yahoo or any place, they will make you read something like this and write what it is. Why? Why? Because AI is the only area where our failures are just as interesting as our successes. So if AI can't do it, it's just as interesting. Okay, if there is an AI, if a program can easily read these kind of letters, right, then you should not be putting these as the test. I mean, I hope you understood that what's happening here is you're trying to tell whether a program or a human being is actually opening an account. Right? And, you know, when they originally started this, you know, very quickly, lots of people wrote large number of programs which will just open accounts where they will store their, you know, free storage. You can store all your stuff on that, but on a Yahoo's expense. Okay, and they can open thousands and thousands of accounts under minutes if it's a program. Whereas humans, you assume, have better things to do in life than making thousands and thousands of accounts within a day. Okay? So they basically, once people started writing programs which will make computers think that they are humans, I mean, are you confused enough? I mean, once people started writing programs that will make computers think that they are humans, then humans had to write programs which can tell automatically whether the thing that is sending input is a human or a computer. Now you thought you don't need Turing test, but you do need Turing test. Yahoo needs Turing test every day. Okay? Now, of course, this is one case, and one of the interesting things is I actually asked you to read. This is basically, these are called captures, which are completely automatically telling humans and computers apart. Okay, that's what it is. And all they're doing is they're looking at things that AI can't do. And if AI can't do, that means there are no programs that can do it. And then they're making tests based on that. And in fact, one of the interesting things that the guy, I heard the talk by Lee Wan An, who came up with this idea for captures, and he mentioned the following fact, which is the program which generates this cannot read this. If it can, then I can copy that program and use it. So he mentioned that this is like professors who set tests that they themselves don't know how to answer. Okay, which is good, you know. So here is a program which made this, and only humans, and it, of course, I mean, what it does is it starts with, you know, it's not that hard to make this. You start with ET76. How many of you don't think that there's an E and T and 7 and 6 here? It's a free eye test also here today. So, and then you start with ET76, and then you do certain image transformation. And it turns out that OCRs are very easy to defeat based on the kind of transformations you do. And one of the interesting arguments that this paper on CAPTCHA says is, it's titled, How Lazy Cryptographers Do AI. And what their point is either it's already known how to do this automatically, in which case you would have figured out, you know, Yahoo finds out day after tomorrow that they have 10,000 accounts per minute being made, so they'll remove this test. Okay, or it, nobody yet knows how to automatically read it, and so there is a monetary motive, so enough people will start trying to solve the problem. Right now, you are just out of the goodness of your heart came to this class. But imagine if there was money involved, if I started saying, I'll give you like $10 every day you come to the class. You know, depending on how desperate you are, I'll have more students. Right? So here there is an economic motive, and people might actually solve this. In fact, some of these things now can be solved faster, more easily. Okay. Now, of course, if that is done, that still doesn't mean that we can't capture computers. This is the next layer. So you show these four pictures and say what's common between them. Snakes. How many of you think there are programs which can figure this out? Like zero chance right now. I would love for there to be programs which can figure this out. But this is a beautiful thing because we are using the failures of AI to keep away the bad guys. Now, this is not that surprising from a cryptography point of view because they have also been using inability to factorize large numbers as the cryptographic standard. So once somebody figures out, in fact, one of the biggest worries people have about Riemann hypothesis is, if Riemann hypothesis is proved, suddenly there may wind up being a technique which will help you factorize numbers. Nobody knows how, but you know, it might factorize numbers much faster, in which case most of our infrastructure for secure communications will go out the window. Is it bad? Not necessarily, because if, you know, none of you would have solved Riemann hypothesis unless there was a real good reason. And this is a good reason. Okay. I don't know whether I should do this, but maybe I should do this. Arms races are interesting. In fact, this is not necessarily about, we're still in the first definition of AI, which is acting humanly. And then we said if somebody does make something act humanly, then you can figure out whether it is succeeded or not using a Turing test. And we looked at CAPTCHAs as a way of doing Turing tests practically right now. Okay, now here's an interesting anecdote, which is, if you don't want to solve it, right, I mean, I'll find a very nice Dilbert cartoon and show it to you next week, but what's the cheapest way to make an intelligent agent? All of you figured this out in junior high, okay, and don't make me tell you this, but human, make a human. That's the easiest, cheapest, you know, you don't need specialized training. Okay, I won't go into details, but it's very easy to do. Okay, now the interesting thing is, if there are enough intelligent agents going around doing nothing, make them do your work for you and put a big box around it and say, intelligent agent. That's okay. And in fact, the original, there are several several ways in which this has been used. One of the earliest times when somebody tried to say, I think a Hungarian guy, I forgot the name of this. Will, do you remember? I'll show you guys the picture again. There's a Hungarian magician who essentially said, I have figured out this machine which does humans, and it turns out it's actually a human inside the machine. You know, that's the cheapest way to make a machine human. Now, these were all fun jokes before, but now, because of the web, there are a huge number of jobless people who can be co-opted into doing your work for you. Yes, Will? Turk, exactly. The machine is called the Turk, and in fact, there's a very interesting point about it, which is, we are going slightly off, but it's interesting enough anyway. Amazon, so in fact, one of the problems in on the web right now is Google actually sucks. Google is the only thing that's available, so we all are happy with it. But Google actually cannot tell that there's a snake here. Okay, so the way images are retrieved in Google is somebody has put annotations saying this picture has a snake, this picture has a green leaf and a snake, and then it does keyword search. It doesn't even do NLP, it just does keyword search. So the question is, how do I get people to sit and annotate images? And furthermore, there is this saying, right, that you get what you pay for. So if I ask people to just freely annotate images, what stops them from saying this, George Bush, this, Saddam Hussein, this, Rao, something like that, right? How do you know? You can't tell. You're just dependent upon these random people who just logged in and started giving you. So this is a huge problem right now. And there are two answers to it. One answer actually was called the M-Turk project, based on the Turk, the original Hungarian thing, which was Amazon's smart idea. What they said was, we'll pay you like 2 cents, 15 cents or something, for any for some number of images that you annotate. And very quickly, the $3 billion that they had in the bank got over, because people just very quickly went and started doing it. Now, that didn't go anywhere, because they still have to check whether you're right or wrong. Do you understand what I'm saying? Checking is just as bad. Now, this is important. As you're laughing, think about the following thing. One of the things we'll do in this class very soon, by next week or something, is talking about solutions for search problems and the correctness of the solution, optimality of the solution. Correctness of a solution oftentimes is a local property. If I give you a solution, if you know enough about the domain, you can tell whether it's correct or not. So think of traveling salesperson problem, where you're going around various cities and coming back to the initial city. And our traveling salesperson problem, the important question is, can you find the optimal such tour? Now, if I give you a tour and I say it's a tour, you can tell whether it's a tour or not. Because if I'm going to the same city 15 times, it's not a tour. A tour must go to each city exactly once. Now I'll give you a solution and say it's optimal. How do you check that? That's like Amazon's problem. Either you have to trust me and saying, Rao is a good guy, why would he lie? Or you actually enumerate all the tours and find out the optimum one and check whether that's the same as this. That's hugely dumb. So when you write a program that is supposed to generate an optimal solution, you have to prove a theorem saying when it ends, it will be optimal. That's it. Because there's no other way. If you have to go into the loop and start trying to check whether it's optimal or not, you lost the game. Right? That's the same thing with Amazon. Now, here is an interesting game called ESP. How many of you have heard of ESP game? Okay. ESP is, again, the guy who came up with CAPTCHAs came up with the ESP game. When you go home, do ESP.net, and you can play this game. It's a beautiful game. It essentially is based on, how many of you can figure out what this picture is? Even if you didn't see this. This is from Tom Sawyer, right? What was the incident about Tom Sawyer that this is showing? Tansar essentially was getting other people to do his work for free by making them think that he's actually doing them a favor. So he was supposed to be painting the wall, and he doesn't want to. So he starts, you know, ooing and moaning as if he's having like great pleasure in doing this, and every kid is standing around saying, "What are you doing? Let me do it, please, let me do it." And then pretty soon he's sitting in the back on an ICG chair, and bunches of small kids were painting the wall. Okay? That's a great thing to do. If you can figure out a way of having other people do your work, it's not bad. So what ESP does essentially is to make people feel good about annotating pictures. Furthermore, it increases the chance that they are not going to be cheating. What they do, it turns out, is two random people are shown the same picture, and you have to independently start writing words that correspond to that picture. Whenever the word here appears in the word in the other guy's list, you both get a point. So you feel good because we are made to think points are good. You know, I mean, you know, my kid goes to all these places and, you know, gets all these ticker tapes which are points. You know, even if $10 are converted into 5 useless points, that's still good. Okay, so you all feel good that you got some number of points. But the system is getting two random people who have no reason to cheat the system to agree that there's a snake in this picture. So then I don't have to go and check. Okay, we went far, far away from just making a single computer program act humanly. Okay, but what we did do has connections to understanding how humans act and either imitating them or understanding their motives and using them to do intelligent programming for you. This is something that I won't teach you here in this class other than today's class, but it's not a bad idea. You know, why would I do heavy duty list programming if I can get some of you guys and put a little box around you and make you my intelligent agent? Free. Okay. There was a question? Okay. There's an arms race about CAPTCHAs. Read this. I won't go into it. The second thing, and we spent a lot of time on acting humanly, you could do thinking humanly as the goal of AI. Okay. Now, if you're interested in thinking humanly, then what would you be doing? You have to understand what is the right, how do people think? So you essentially need to do tests on human thought process. There's a whole area called cognitive psychology, neuroscience, cognitive neuroscience, whose main goals are this. Okay. Now, acting humanly is not, the complete AI cannot actually be characterized in terms of acting humanly, but there is a overlap. And similarly, thinking humanly, complete AI is not about thinking humanly. It doesn't really matter whether you think the way humans do in beating the heck out of Kasparov. In fact, all chess grandmasters agree that when Deep Blue beat Kasparov, that was not the way human grandmasters would have played in terms of their thinking. Because humans apparently do patterns. They look at patterns on table. Now, you know, several people are doing, but I know we are also extremely good at making ourselves look good. You know, if somebody asks me, if I, you know, find out some interesting theorem and then you ask me, how did you find this theorem, I'll make a nice romantic story. I'm not going to tell you that, my God, I had to write 10,000 ideas and throw away the 9,999 bad ones to find the good one. There's only one guy, Linus Pauling, who got 2 Nobel Prizes. When asked, how does he get good ideas, said, well, I get a lot of ideas, I throw away the bad ones, which is a much simpler explanation of intelligence, but we won't admit that. I don't know if that's the reason or not, but Kasparov definitely thinks that he looks at bigger patterns, whereas Deep Blue does brute force processing. Okay, so there is an advantage, there is a case where if you think Deep Blue is AI, then it's not thinking humanly. No. It's hard enough to actually figure out how humans are thinking. They don't allow lobotomies easily. So what we probably say, this is, yeah, it's connected. We would like to know how humans think so that maybe we can do it in the program. But really what we want to do is do what humans do, you know, which is intelligent behavior directly. If there's a way, another way of getting there, we won't mind. If there's another way of winning chess, I don't necessarily have to think like Kasparov. Okay, I mean, we know that computers don't do arithmetic the way we do arithmetic. And we know that mechanical gadgets don't lift weights the way we lift weights. So why should suddenly intelligent behavior should be done exactly the way we do it? There's no reason. Okay. The third one is don't think humanly, think rationally. Now thinking rationally, of course, is what you do and your friend doesn't do. You know, we normally tell our friend, you know, you are irrational, we are thinking rationally. But there is actually a huge field there of, you know, starting from Greeks, starting from Socrates and so on, who started talking about what is the right way to think. I know that all the bozos around me don't seem to be doing it, but the right way to think basically involves some mathematical logic. You know, syllogisms, modus ponens, modus tollens, all this stuff came up in, you know, in Greece way back when, because they were trying to figure out, even if humans are fallible, let's just figure out what's the right way to think. And the right way is a rational way to think. So there was a whole area, areas developed, which talked about trying to encode rational reasoning processes. Mathematical logic is one, probabilistic logic is another, you know, all that stuff. Now, the problem, of course, is I don't necessarily know that all intelligent action is connected to logical thinking. Okay, there are sometimes we just do reflexive action. And ultimately what matters is you don't get a big prize because you thought about what is the best exit to take when a tiger is, you know, coming at very fast speed towards you. You know, because you die if you take too much time trying to figure out which exit to run away from. The guy who hasn't taken any rational thought, all that stuff, and just runs for the heck of it, is likely to win, no? Because he or she will live. Okay? So, if survival is compromised, then the fact that you died thinking the most rational thought doesn't help. Okay? So, this is important. It is important to understand how rational thinking works, but it's not enough. Again, this too is a piece of the puzzle. So, AI would be interested in figuring out how to do rational thought, rational thinking. So we will talk about logical reasoning, probabilistic reasoning, and search and all that stuff. Okay, but that's not the only thing. Okay, so then since the class is getting over, the last definition has to be the one that we will give a little more preference to, which is acting rationally. I don't really care what's under the hood. As long as agent A seems to get better marks on some performance test than agent B, agent A wins. And so I will have to figure out how to write an agent which will act rationally. Rationally acting essentially means maximizing your expected benefit. Okay? So ultimately we would actually look at this for this course, and generally current understanding is people who say they are AI people, not necessarily cognitive neuroscientists or not necessarily logicians, they tend to differentiate themselves from the other guys by this. Okay, so they don't necessarily care about whether they're doing logical thinking or not. They're caring about whether you can actually set up an experiment where this agent it maximizes its utility. So it basically, irrespective of whether it's thinking right or wrong, it's acting right. Now it doesn't have to act, the act right should not be defined in terms of acting like human, because then we'll be back to the first definition. Acting right should be defined in terms of some objective function that's being optimized. So for example, if you are trying to write an intelligent stock agent, right, there's an obvious, you know, objective function, which is in 10 years, you know, every agent is given the same amount of money in the beginning, and after 1 year or 10 years, we go and look at their total portfolio value. It doesn't matter if agent A basically kept looking at crystal balls and won the stock market, whereas agent B did a lot of thinking and lost all its money. As far as we are concerned, whoever has the most money after 2 years has won. Rationally speaking, that's the only way of, you know, differentiating between two stock agents. So similarly, I want to have to write these objective functions, a performance metrics for any task that I'm interested in. And I am trying to write programs. And when I say agents in this class, I just mean programs. Programs which may have, you know, which may have some hardware, you know, so it looks like a cute robot, but in general, we are more interested in the program aspect of it, which will essentially get high marks in terms of these performance metrics. It's not necessary that it would have to be doing exactly the thing that humans do. Now, here's an interesting last point that I want to make is think of something like machine translation. Okay? Now, I hope there are some people here who know more than one language. And, you know, so if you know another language, then presumably you can look at that language and translate what that language is saying into English, let's say, because all of us need to understand English. So the question then is, if I write a program which is doing this machine translation automatically, how do I test whether it has done right translation or not? Now, currently, unfortunately, so I did say that I want to provide an objective performance metric. How do I provide an objective performance metric for machine translation? Translate it back. Why would that make sense? In fact, that way. That, why is that bad, by the way? That's like hugely bad, unfortunately. I mean, it's a hugely bad thing because I can make English variable names. For each word in that language, I'll say X, Q, Y, Z is that word. Okay? And then when the program translates it back, it says X, Q, Y, Z means, you know, happiness in Italian. How do you set up machine translation objective function? Now, there's a problem for which, there are problems for which you can set up objective, you know, performance metrics, objective performance metrics, such as, for example, traveling salesperson problem. You know, there's no question. You know, the idea is to find the shortest circuit. So you don't need to figure out whether Italians would agree with your solution or Indians will agree with your solution. There's just one math, okay? Translation is trickier. In fact, there are machine translation competitions right now. Now, you know what happens in that competition? In fact, again, this is another thing that I just heard last week. NIST, National Institute of Standards, has, not surprisingly, shown a lot of interest in translating Arabic text into English. Okay? And so Google entered the competition, a bunch of other people entered the competition, and so they're all doing machine translation. And so the question is, who did best? Who did best was judged essentially by a score called the Blue Score, BLEU, or some such thing, which essentially is whether you agreed with a pre-selected bunch of human experts. The unfortunate thing is, native speakers of both languages, I mean, so if I know Arabic and English extremely well, I might still get like 25% on the Blue Score because the experts don't seem to agree with me. Do you understand what I'm saying? This is a problem we have to deal with, you know. However, so I wanted to say two things. One is you want to set up a objective performance metric with respect to which you are trying to optimize your program's behavior, okay? And I wanted you to go a second order and realize that sometimes it's not obvious what is the objective performance metric. In fact, I said something. You let me go because you wanted to leave soon and it is becoming 3 o'clock. I said a rational agent should maximize its expected utility. This is like your parents saying, maybe I hope some of your parents said this, that honesty is the best policy. Do you agree? Do you disagree? Well, I mean, you won't definitely disagree in front of me, I mean, you know, in front of the whole darn class, but think about this. Maximal expected utility essentially says, if this agent were to live 10,000 times, I mean, so if you play the game 10,000 times, right, your agent is winning 9,000 times, whereas the other guy's agent is winning 8,700 times. Okay, that's what is maximal expected utility. And sometimes, I mean, part of the problem is, you know, you have to admit whether or not that we agree with that as a rational performance metric. In fact, humans don't seem to agree with rational performance metric. The last point for today. Who is the only computer scientist who got a Nobel Prize? This is trivia, AI, everything in this class. Yahoo, everything. So who is the only computer scientist who got a Nobel Prize? You do know that mathematicians are not allowed to get Nobel Prizes. There's a story about, you know, Alfred Nobel's wife having an affair with a mathematician, which at least tells me that she has good taste. But you know, apparently Nobel said no mathematician shall ever get any piece of my money. And computer scientists oftentimes tend to be mathematicians. And, you know, I don't really believe, and neither of you would believe, that software engineers will get a Nobel Prize. So they're out. So which is the only computer scientist who got a Nobel Prize? What? Alan Turing didn't get Nobel Prize. By the way, all of you, go read Wikipedia entry on Alan Turing. Every year, I'm surprised at how few people know, how little people know about Turing. Okay, I mean, I'm not asking you to read the thick books, but at least read something about the guy. You know, he's a very interesting story. It turns out there's a large amount of general interest about his life other than just his computer science thing. But, you know, Turing didn't get an award. Turing gives awards. The highest award in computer science is the Turing Award. Chomsky didn't get it either. What? No. None of the, no. So, a guy who happens to be there in one of my pictures earlier, let me show you that, and that really, really is the last picture I'll show you. I can't see anything. I can't do it. Okay. Yeah. A guy whose name, and I want to show you how he looks too. Okay. No. This guy. Herbert Simon. And he got it because he was an economist. And why did I bring this up instead of letting you go? Because he got his Nobel Prize for showing, surprise, surprise, that human organizations don't behave rationally. We already know humans don't behave rationally. Okay? He has studied Milwaukee Municipal Corporation and their decision making over a period of years and has convincingly shown that, you know, while we think multiple brains are somehow better than one, they still are not rational. We are always putting up fires. That's about it. You know, so in essence, he essentially shows that human organizations don't behave perfectly rationally. Okay, and one of the interesting points then is if human organizations don't behave rationally, maybe we shouldn't make rationality as perfect rationality as the requirement for computer programs. Why make it harder than what humans are doing? Okay, and one of the interesting things then, in fact, this has happened. We now think that there are multiple ways of defining perfect rationality. One definition takes into account the computation that is spent in coming to the decision. Much of the reason that you actually don't wind up being perfectly rational is because you are lazy. You know, perfectly rational thing to do would be to get 100 out of 100 in this course. But many of you tend to think that it's actually useful to have a life outside of the course. And because of which, you don't get 100 out of 100. You think it's rational. I don't, but you think it's rational. And partly what you're doing is you are taking computation time plus the execution time. And there are interesting ways of defining rationality that came up because of this guy. By the way, now since I'm showing this, this is John McCarthy. He got Kyoto Prize, which is this Japanese equivalent of Nobel Prize. That's the only thing you and I can get, unless some of you are economists. This is Alan Newell, who was the first graduate student of Simon. If you read something about Simon, read the idea of Simon's aunt, not Simon's aunt. I mean, on the other hand, I don't know, my pronunciation is so bad, I can't tell. The ant which is going on a beach. And if you're looking at the ant from upstairs, right, the ant is going here and coming back, going like this, coming back, and it's doing a very complex motion on the beach. You could think, man, this ant is one real intelligent ant. But ant is actually not intelligent. All it's doing is keep going. If I hit myself on a grain of salt and sand, turn back. So his point, which, you know, was that perceived intelligence is a combination of a simple agent. It could be a combination of a simple agent in a complex environment. Close your brain, right? So how many of us are ants? You know, we think we are intelligent, but, you know, essentially our environment is made easy for us. So that's, so you should read about Simon's ant there. This guy is Marvin Minsky. And these four guys had a conference in Dartmouth in 1956, where in fact McCarthy wrote the proposal to have this little conference, which those were the conferences where people will come, 10 people will come and stay for the entire summer. And this year was the 50th anniversary of that conference. During that conference, this guy came up with the name artificial intelligence, which some people think is a little too hyperbole. Some other people think, you know, have it, it's a nice name, you know, beat software engineering, you know, which has not as much appeal. Okay, we'll stop here. What we'll do next class is go into chapter 2, which is architectures for intelligent agents. Please read the chapter, understand the types of environment and types of agent design, and we'll talk about them next class.